This is The Takeaway for Thursday, July 6th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening today. North Korea is showing the world its new longer-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, analysts say a nuclear strike using those missiles is still very unlikely, but there's no doubt that the improved capability is changing the calculations of everyone within range. Here's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley speaking at the UN on Wednesday.
Make no mistake, North Korea's launch of an ICBM is a clear and sharp military escalation. The North Korean regime openly states that its missiles are intended to deliver nuclear weapons to strike cities in the United States, South Korea, and Japan. And now it has greater capacity to do so.
New resolutions condemning North Korea may be coming soon at the United Nations. Meanwhile, far from UN headquarters in New York, the residents of Hawaii are starting to prepare for what seems like a return to the nuclear preparedness of the Cold War. We're going to hear about Hawaii's new reality in just a few minutes, but no country experiences the risk of North Korean escalation like its South Korean neighbor. And that's where we begin today. Joining me now to discuss what preparedness looks like in South Korea is Sungyoon Lee, professor in Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Boston. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And it's wonderful to have you. You know, we hear so much about this belligerent and unpredictable neighbor to the north for South Koreans. Do South Koreans live in a climate of constant threat?
Yes, they do, but there's a blasé attitude on the part of the South Korean government and the public at large, and the reasons are complex, but the past 64 years since the end of the Korean War in 1953 has been a period of de facto peace, unstable but real peace and real prosperity for the South Korean people. About 75% of the South Korean population have no first-hand experience, no recollection of the war. All they know is affluence and freedom, and that means that there's a sort of a denialist mentality when it comes to viewing the North. They see North Korea more as a pesky, poor neighbor rather than a security threat.
So you talked about a blasé attitude on the streets of Seoul among young people. What does blasé mean? That even though there are thousands of pieces of artillery just over the border, people just kind of go about their regular lives and don't worry about it?
I think so. And I think national education is a factor in this. With a change in the government, North Korea policy and narratives teaching about North Korea changes dramatically. I remember 10 years ago in the summer of 2007, there was a survey in a major Korean newspaper asking elementary school students who were the major belligerents in the Korean War. And the majority of respondents replied it was South Korea versus Japan. So there is a tendency to have sort of a romantic attachment or to view North Korea in an illusory way on the part of the general public. And I would say in defense of this kind of apathy or ignorance that South Koreans cannot live in constant fear of North Korea. But I think on the other hand, there is a lack of war preparedness, alertness, and basic information about North Korea. There is really no money in North Korean studies. That's a terrible pun, but there are very few colleges in South Korea that offer majors, a college major in North Korean studies. People don't want to talk about North Korea too much, lest they be understood, mistaken as a North Korea sympathizer. And all these are contributing factors to the general ignorance, indifference, and lack of war preparedness.
These are some of the factors in South Korean culture, Professor, that you mentioned. But these are two countries technically still in a state of war 63 years later, as you mentioned. What about the military preparedness within the halls of government? Are there bomb shelters around Seoul? Are there regular drills? Do people who are in a position and are paid to care about this stuff prepare?
Those who are paid to care about this stuff, yes, they do. But when you imagine, say, the residents of Manhattan, are they prepared for an invasion or a war even after 9/11, now many years ago? Probably not. There are bomb shelters, thousands actually, mostly subway stations. And South Korea has one of the world's best, most efficient subway system. But do the people know what exactly to do in case They are shelled in the heart of Seoul. When you think of Manhattan, multiply, magnify that by multiple times, you have this big metropolis, which is Seoul, with a population of over 10 million, lying vulnerable to North Korean barrage of artillery. And this kind of reality has implications, that is, which favor North Korea. We know the regime in North Korea has very little regard for human life. If they were to go to war, I think South Korea would be more prone to placate North Korea. South Korea does not want to escalate tension with North Korea because, again, there has been unprecedented growth, prosperity, and happiness over the past 60 years. We have too much to lose. That's what South Koreans feel.
We're used to consuming, even here in the United States, the sort of regular bellicose threatening rhetoric from North Korea. And I always assumed that that type of rhetoric had a much bigger impact in South Korea even than it would have here, because they're so close by and they understand the nuance so much better. But does it just wash over them in a way?
I think it does. And then there's at times a strange response from responsible government officials. I remember when North Korea gave the U.S. a 7-rocket salute, firing off 6 short-range missiles and 1 long-range missile on July 4th in 2006. The head of the South Korean counterpart of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee said, well, that long-range missile is targeting the U.S. It's not targeting us, so we shouldn't be concerned. So this kind of, you know, irresponsible and blasé response and attitude are exhibited among responsible government officials occasionally as well.
Real threats from North Korea and new missile capabilities met sometimes, at least across South Korean culture, with maybe a more relaxed attitude. Seung-Yung Lee, professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you sail east across the Pacific Ocean, just about 4,500 miles from North Korea, you can run into Hawaii, and that puts Hawaii within range, apparently, of the missile that North Korea tested on Tuesday. It wasn't the first North Korean test, of course. The regime's been launching missiles into the sea all year long with longer and longer ranges. And earlier this year, Hawaii began working to prepare. Is a return to Cold War preparedness now a reality in sunny Hawaii? Matthew Lopresti is a Democratic state representative from Hawaii's 41st district who introduced a resolution in the House in Hawaii to improve the state's readiness. And he joins me now. Matthew Lopresti, welcome.
Aloha. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been decades since Hawaii or anyone else, frankly, worried about what to actually do if there's a nuclear strike. But you say that it's time for Hawaii to start worrying about it.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't think that we should be talking about fallout shelters again. Makes them obviously uncomfortable, but with the nuclear-armed or potentially nuclear-armed ICBMs that maximum range could reach Hawaii, well, we need to really start looking at these things in a sober way.
Well, what should nuclear preparedness look like in Hawaii? Surely you're not going to have kids crawling under desks and doing duck and cover like they did in the Cold War 50s.
Look, Hawaii obviously is in the middle of the largest ocean on the planet, so we already have a culture of preparedness and resiliency when it comes to natural disasters. And really what it would entail is using those same kind of preparations in case of man-made disaster. We have to look at the reality if, say, our port was taken out by a tsunami, hurricane, or war. We as individual citizens need to be prepared to survive for 14 days, you know, before we can get supplies again. One thing that the state DOD and the state Hawaii Emergency Management Agency has been great at and doing and working with me on this is looking at getting the message out to the population as to what they can do, what would be expected of them, and what they could expect from government.
A lot of this is the very basic preparedness, as you say, that comes with living in a place where tsunamis and earthquakes can happen.
Yes, but I mean, we have to keep in mind that even if or even when, say, North Korea is able to miniaturize, say, a nuclear warhead, and if they can hit what they're aiming at, even if they did hit us, it would be a limited mass casualty event, meaning there would be hundreds of thousands of survivors, and the threat that would be fallout. You know, we're not talking about bomb shelters. There's no civilian bomb shelters. These shelters wouldn't protect people from thermal blast, it would protect them from the fallout. And you need to know what to do. I mean, my generation from the Cold War, we were educated as part of our culture as the kinds of things that would be expected in those kinds of events. We have a new generation of citizens who did not live through that, but maybe that's the new reality, and we need to re-educate the population as to what would happen, what would be the effects, and how and what you can do to protect you and your family.
Are you encountering any psychological resistance to this idea? What do Hawaiians say back to you when you say, hey, it's time to prepare for a potential nuclear strike?
Well, I mean, the people of Hawaii, I think, appreciate and understand that we in the islands are a symbolic and strategic target in case of some kind of global conflict. But the feedback that I've gotten is mostly appreciative that people in government are beginning to take this more seriously. I mean, one of the reasons that I really started to get involved in this is I found that there was no plan except from a 1985 plan. But we're updating that now, and we're looking at re-identifying shelters, what kinds of things realistically can we do. And, you know, people expect that of government, and frankly, the feedback I've gotten is that people appreciate that we're taking it seriously.
Matthew Lopresti, this ICBM test from the North Koreans happened to occur at a time when you're all the way on the other side of the country in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. What are officials there saying to you about the seriousness of this, and are they going to help you pay for it?
Well, I am here in D.C. For a conference, but also I was going to meet with our congressional delegation and their staff to talk about missile prepared or missile defense and disaster prep. I'm going to be asking them to help try to find some federal funds to help our state emergency management agency update its plans and put out public service announcements as to what people can do, what they could expect, web-based content, printed brochures. You know, these are things that the state DOD is already doing, but it always helps to have some federal funds because in the Cold War, the shelters were, I think, universally paid for by the federal government. And if we have a president whose bluster and blunder is going to be exposing the citizens of our state to possible attack, then I think it's incumbent upon the president and Congress to provide our citizens and the 11 military bases in our state with some form of not just improved missile defense protection, but also disaster preparedness for the citizens after an event would occur, however unlikely.
Matthew Lopresti is a Democratic state representative from the 41st District in Hawaii. Matthew Lopresti, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump was in Poland today for a short visit before heading to Hamburg, Germany for the G20 summit. The president found a warm host in Poland's right-wing populist government, perhaps more than traditional European allies like in the UK and France. And some in the European Union worry that Trump's visit could be seen as an endorsement of Poland's move toward a more restrictive government. Lately, the EU has criticized Poland for clamping down on free press and the country's judicial system. The president gave a speech in Krasinski Square earlier today, the site of the Warsaw Uprising in 1944, near the end of World War II. He touched on the nation's history and spoke of modern threats like ISIS.
This continent no longer confronts the specter of communism. But today we're in the West, and we have to say there are dire threats to our security and to our way of life. You see what's happening out there. They are threats. We will confront them. We will win. But they are threats.
Ann Applebaum is following the president's visit in Poland and his speech. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of Gulag, A History, also a columnist for The Washington Post. Ann Applebaum, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
Ann, Donald Trump may be in friendlier territory in Poland than he could have expected in other parts of Europe. There's been an apparent weakening of the white nationalist international. They've had losses in France and the Netherlands and Austria over the past several months. But in Poland, it's alive and well.
Well, it's a little unfair to call them the white nationalist international in Poland because they were really elected a year before Trump's, you know, white nationalist international got underway. But yes, it's true that the current Polish government is a nationalist government. It is a government that is suspicious of the press. It has been very detrimental to the judiciary. It's been at odds with a lot of its European neighbors. And in that sense, it has been really also at odds with the history of Poland over the last 25 years. What it has in common with Trump, actually, interestingly, is that it's also a minority government in the sense that it was elected by far less than 50% of the public. But thanks to the electoral laws, they nevertheless control the government. And yet they want to act like a, you know, we speak for the real people against the fake elites. I mean, in that sense, they ran a campaign very similar to Trump's. So, yes, he was welcomed by a crowd that was specially invited there and was, in fact, bussed in from around the country of government supporters. I'm not sure that the rest of the country will have welcomed him with anything like that.
So is there a real strategic confluence between these two countries then with the defeats that we've mentioned in places like France with the Front National, in the Netherlands and Austria? Brexit was a success for the allies of President Trump, at least in Britain. What does he see in Poland? What do they see in each other that might be to mutual benefit?
Well, as I said, they have some electoral tactics in common. This Polish government has been very, very loud about not wanting any Islamic refugees in the country and about the danger from refugees, even though this is a country that has actually no Islamic refugees at all. They've taken none. Nevertheless, they have successfully used the threat of some kind of foreign invasion. The complicated piece of the story with Poland and the U.S. is that what Poland is really afraid of and what really threatens Poland is intervention not from the Islamic world, which it's very far away from, but from Russia. Poles are afraid both militarily of Russia and they're afraid of Russian intervention in their democracy and their information space, the same way that Russia intervenes in the democracy and information space elsewhere in Europe. And Trump didn't mention that. I mean, there were a couple of allusions that you could have interpreted to he might have meant Russia, but he didn't mention it.
Well, let's listen to one of the comments from President Trump in Krasinski Square today.
And so I am here today not just to visit an old ally, but to hold it up as an example for others who seek freedom and who wish to summon the courage and the will to defend our civilization.
So, Ann Applebaum, there is President Trump talking about defending the civilization, really defending maybe some of his own politics. But if Poles are used to an American president talking tough about Russia, as you said, they didn't get it there.
No, they didn't get it. Also, it wasn't really clear what he meant by civilization. One of the words that he didn't use in that speech was democracy. He didn't talk about defending Western democracy or reinforcing Western democracy. And this, of course, will have pleased his hosts, who are right now engaged in a kind of assault on democratic norms, on the press, on the judiciary, and on other norms in Poland, and that will have cheered them. But the question is also, our civilization, if it's not about democracy, and if it's really about each nation's own, I don't know, defending its own identity, which he also spoke about in the speech, then what guarantee does Poland have that at some future date, some U.S. president is really going to defend them, or that other Europeans will come to defend them? I mean, the U.S. is a long way away from Poland, and Poland's safety really depends on other Europeans. And I think a Poland that solely allies itself with the U.S. and turns its back on Europe is not a safe country.
Well, these are meetings, Ann Applebaum, and certainly speeches that Russia is watching as closely as we are. If you are Vladimir Putin to the east, watching the speeches that took place today, do you like what you see?
I don't know if it's fair to say that he likes them, but he certainly didn't hear what he would have heard from other presidents in the past, which is, you know, America's longstanding commitment going back to World War II. He wouldn't have heard about, you know, America as a part of a larger, you know, transatlantic alliance. He didn't hear other countries mentioned. So, yes, he might have felt there's certainly some chinks opening up in what was once a kind of a really solid front of the transatlantic nations.
Let's talk about the U.S.-Russia relationship, Ann Applebaum, quickly before we let you go. By the end of the week, we will have this bilateral meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. Back home, the Senate is trying to take away the president's ability to lift sanctions against Russia. How will Vladimir Putin know he has the U.S. where he wants them after these meetings? And how will he know if things are not going quite his way?
First of all, one of the very strange things about this meeting is that even Trump's aides have said they actually have absolutely no idea what he's going to say to President Putin. I mean, I think what Putin is looking for is he's looking for exactly what I was talking about before, which is a kind of chink in that democratic wall. He wants to be able to crack down on his dissidents. He wants to be able to invade his neighbors with impunity. He wants to be able to act like a dictator in his part of the world. He wants the United States to tolerate that and then presumably to do deals with him elsewhere and to work with him elsewhere. He, of course, would also like to hear that we're lifting sanctions. As you've just said, that might be made more difficult by the U.S. Congress, although remember that it would have to be not just the Senate, but also the House. And the House seems to be torn on that issue right now. What Putin does not want to hear would be, again, a restatement in a clear way, not just kind of a vague discussion of civilization, but a more specific commitment to rule of law in Europe, to the sanctity of borders in Europe, the historic American commitment to European unity. If he hears those things, then he knows that all the effort he put into getting Trump elected would have been in vain.
The president of the United States in Poland with a different message than we're used to hearing from American presidents and that the Russians are used to hearing as well. Anne Applebaum, author of Gulag, a History, columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two looks at the auto industry now, at home and abroad. First, let's go to Europe, where Swedish carmaker Volvo announced on Wednesday that it will be transitioning to electric and hybrid cars by 2019. Here's the CEO of Volvo, Håkan Samuelsson.
We are determined to be the first premium car maker to move our entire portfolio of vehicles into electrification. This is a clear commitment towards reducing our carbon footprint, as well as contributing to a better air quality in our cities.
Now that means that from 2019 on, all new Volvo cars will be either electric or a hybrid. But does this announcement really mark a significant change for the car industry? And what can we expect from other competitors? Joining us now is Rebecca Lindland. She's an executive analyst for Kelley Blue Book. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on, Todd.
A big announcement from Volvo there. Is this really the end of the internal combustion engine?
I think it was a great headline. I think it may have been a little bit of an exaggeration, though. You know, Volvo sold about 535,000 vehicles last year. And just for perspective, that's about half of what the U.S. market will sell in a couple of weeks. So it's a small player, but it's an interesting announcement for sure.
But how big of an announcement is it? I mean, when we look at U.S. auto sales, maybe Europe is different. There's this reaction you always get. People love to talk about hybrid and electric cars, but nobody really buys them. I mean, even in California, which is the leader, I read that only 3% of the total fleet is hybrid.
You took my favorite line. Actually, it's incredibly low. For the U.S. market overall, it's 2.2% in 2016. 2.2%, which means that, you know, 98% of people are picking something else and they're picking internal combustion engines. And so I think we need to put this into perspective. I think what Volvo is doing is admirable, but it's not necessarily what I would describe as groundbreaking. When you think about Tesla, they really are the electric vehicle leader right now. They've always been all electric. And what Volvo is doing is looking at electrifying their fleet, but also using internal combustion engines. And that's what's getting a little bit lost in the message. And that's why I think that some of these announcements are borderline hysterical in proclaiming the death of the internal combustion engine.
So, Rebecca Lindland, if this relatively small automaker, Volvo, follows through with this announcement and they electrify or hybridize by 2024, let's say, at what point will we know that the auto industry really has fundamentally changed in a way that cuts the carbon emissions from all those millions of cars that we drive? When will we know it's real?
You know, I think it's real now, Todd. I mean, you know, in the States, we've improved our fuel economy for the vehicles that we buy year after year by more than 20% in the last 10 years. We are selecting oftentimes the most fuel efficient version of a vehicle that we already want to buy. The difference, the challenge that we have with electric vehicles and hybrids as well, is that consumers are not demanding those of manufacturers.
So in the end, could that be really risky for Volvo, pushing something onto the market that people aren't necessarily clamoring for?
It's not risky because we've got regulations. And so we've got regulations calling for zero emission vehicles. And that means oftentimes electrification. And we also have autonomous vehicles. That, because of the computing power required to operate an autonomous or self-driving vehicle, we almost need to have electrification on board every vehicle. So I think that Volvo is ahead of the curve in terms of saying we are going to have some form of hybridization across our entire lineup. But at the same time, we have to understand that other manufacturers, larger manufacturers like Volkswagen, General Motors, BMW, they are all doing this as well. They just haven't made the big announcement yet.
Volvo's cars will be getting better mileage in the future, and it appears that Volvo got some excellent mileage out of a PR announcement this week. Rebecca Lindland, executive analyst for Kelley Blue Book. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Throughout the 2016 presidential campaign, President Trump promised to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. He made the success of America's auto industry a big part of his rallies in Michigan and elsewhere.
General Motors announced that they're adding or keeping 900 jobs right here in Michigan, and that's going to be over the next 12 months. And that's just the beginning, folks. In fact, I told them that's peanuts. That's peanuts.
Those high-flying fortunes for U.S. cars are now reversing somewhat. The industry has now posted 6 consecutive months of declining sales. After a period of growth capped by nearly 2 years of record sales, has the U.S. auto industry peaked? Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld joined me to provide insights into all of this. He served as a consultant to the United Auto Workers and to Ford over the last 2 decades. He's currently a professor in the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. And Joel says when it comes to U.S. cars, it may not yet be time for long-term concern.
The auto industry has always been a cyclical industry, so there will be years that are better or worse. And in that sense, this is nothing new to the industry. On the other hand, there are some longer-term trends that may also be going on, but I wouldn't jump to any immediate fears just because sales are down in the short run.
Well, in the short run, what are we looking at? Are people driving less? Gas prices? What's got the slump going these days?
Well, gas prices actually have been quite favorable for the industry, but there's some of people driving less. In fact, there's some evidence that the next generation of drivers is less likely to own a car. So that's one of those longer term trends that's on the horizon. And then there's combinations of technology and globalization that are impacting the industry. But again, I wouldn't read too much into the short-term numbers, even though in the long term, those are big issues.
Let's talk about some of those longer-term issues. Technology, you mentioned, driverless cars are just around the corner. There is a lot of uncertainty in terms of trade, in terms of NAFTA, free trade deals. So what are planners in the industry looking at in the long term that maybe has them nervous?
It's amazing that driverless cars, which seemed far away on the horizon, are now just around the corner. But it is true. It's happening, and it will be a sea change for the industry. The sense with which somebody attaches their identity to their car comes with ownership and certain patterns that go back to Henry Ford's commitment to bringing mobility to the middle class. And that could all change. It's not that mobility is going away. In fact, that may increase. But the fact that it's car ownership that gets attached to it is what's on the table.
The sharing economy is huge in the auto industry, everything from Uber to Car2Go. It's not fashionable to own anymore.
Well, and that's certainly the generational change that I was talking about. And, you know, it does mean that the fleet of cars on the street may be smaller, but used more intensively which then requires a fleet that's more durable, which again takes you down that path of that power by the hour kind of model. And it combines with other changes that are happening in society. We are seeing both the forces of globalization that are happening on a large scale, but also movements towards increased local self-sufficiency, whether it's around digital fabrication or other technologies. And those are on an accelerating curve as well.
At the same time, Joel, you mentioned the forces of globalization. There are forces pushing back against it. President Trump pulled the United States out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's pledging to renegotiate NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. What are automakers looking for here as the White House tries to undo or recut some of these deals?
The different deals that you mentioned play out differently for the industry. What any president needs to know is that the industry plans on 2, 3, 4 year cycles for new models. It plans much further out on new technology. And so decisions about whether plants are going to be opened or closed or whether models are going to be located in different places are on a multi-year horizon, and jawboning in the short run may have some visible effects that are minor, but for the most part, those decisions are made long in advance. The real issue with NAFTA is that that's something that has grown the auto industry in terms of trade, not just within North America, but also exporting from North America globally. TPP was actually going to sacrifice some gains for Japan in the auto industry against the U.S. in exchange for hegemony relative to China. So if you talk to industry folks, they would say, keep NAFTA, but they were not as enthusiastic about TPP.
So, Joel, if you're an auto worker now in Michigan or Ohio or Tennessee or Alabama, for that matter, and you followed the campaign and you followed the cheerleading that President Trump did for the auto industry sort of as this harbinger for his rebuilding of the American working class, how are you feeling now about the future of your industry and the future of your employment?
Well, and you're right to say that that auto worker could be anywhere up and down the middle of the United States. It's not just in the upper Midwest anymore. I would have to think that most of those folks would worry that Trump really hasn't leaned in to understand the inner workings of how this industry operates. I would want a president who is not just advocating for jobs in general, but who understands how those jobs really get created.
Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld is a professor at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Joel, thanks so much.
Indeed a pleasure, Todd.
So I'll write a list of all the books that I want to read.
Did you read that?
I did. Did you read that thing?
Yeah. Did you read?
Uh-huh.
Did you read?
Mm-hmm.
Did you read?
Of course I did.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Summer is the time to get a cold drink and an umbrella and all those books you've been meaning to read throughout the year, right? Yesterday, we had Ron Charles from The Washington Post giving us his picks for best new fiction. You can find that list on our website at thetakeaway.org. Today, we go into the world of nonfiction. Dana Williams is with me. She's the chair of the Department of English at Howard University and a reader of all things. Dana, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
Dana, summertime is supposed to be for the novel, I guess, but I'm one of those people who has to fight the urge to keep reading nonfiction, and I often lose, so I'm glad you're here.
I think that's true for most people.
Yeah, and it's great to have you. Now, I want to go, you've got some great picks on this list, and as I was reading down on them, I started to compile a list that's going to be too long for me to get through this summer. So let's start with Joan Williams's White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. It's at the top of your list.
Yeah, this is one that I think has been talked about a lot. So in some ways, it became that book that you have to read just because everyone's talking about it. It emerged out of a short essay that she had written shortly after, or if not immediately after, the most recent presidential election. And so I see it as kind of the how did we get here book, if you will. And by here, we mean the era of populist discontent and the Trump era. I think its relevance to the Trump moment and its interrogation of the working class particularly is what is most attractive about the book for most people. It's a little complicated. It's gotten mixed reviews in the sense that it really tries to push back against the elitism that it critiques. So in some ways, the privilege reinscribes itself. But I think it's still a pretty good read in the context of books like Rick Wortsman's The End of Loyalty, which just came out, or in its latest iteration, or then even the Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. I wouldn't read it in isolation. I'd read it in conversation with those other books.
Hillbilly Elegy is a book that everyone just had to read after the election, and this sounds like it's of the same canon.
I would agree. This one, I think the difference, though, to some degree is, again, it tries to close that gap of comprehension, like what we think we know and what we don't know, and just how far off we are from people who've been silent about working class. It, again, has some deficiencies in the sense that it's really ambiguous about what the working class is. She tries to define it in terms of income and values, but the range is so great, it's just not exactly clear who the white working class is. But she's very forthcoming about how complicated that title is and why she chose white working class over working class or blue collar, for instance.
Well, for people who are into politics or social justice or even sports, next on your list, you've got Craig Hodges' Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter.
That one is great. I think this one is a good example, too, of books that you have said, I want to read this book, I got to read this book, I have to read this book. This one, although it came out in January, I didn't get to read it until the beginning of summer, and I'm so glad I did. I wish I had read it a little bit earlier. But, you know, great books last, and you can read them over and over again. But it's a really good book that gives some context to the contemporary activism that we're seeing with sports figures, everyone from Colin Kaepernick to, most recently, LeBron James. Most folks will remember Craig Hodges from being, you know, the great, phenomenal three-point shooter, both in isolation with the three-point contest, but then also in the context of his years playing with NBA teams, particularly the World Championship, one of the World Championships. He was on that second championship team with the Chicago Bulls. And he speaks out about how important activism was to him, how much controversy surrounded his activism on the court and off the court, particularly the letter that he gave to President George Bush, his wearing the dashiki at the White House. But it's more than the controversy story. It's a story about how activism is a central part of his life and had been from the beginning. And so that genealogy, this was my genealogy book. He sees himself in the context of freedom fighters from Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Eartha Kitt, not just sports figures. So I think this is a really good book, an important book that young people can read as well. I think it's a really good read. It's a quick read, too.
And anyone who didn't know that they were into politics or social justice or that kind of history, if they thought they were just into basketball, they might find it interesting. Richard Rothstein has a new one out, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America.
Yeah, this book has gotten a lot of attention, which is ironic, of course, because he talks about this forgotten history. But it's another one of those how do we get here books in some ways, because it makes clear how housing segregation then and now is informed by government law and policy. And we tend to think that people self-segregate, that they choose to live in certain neighborhoods, and that integration happened really late in the 1950s, early 1960s, and that was something that was a matter of the courts to settle in isolated cases. But he talks very specifically about how the civilian public housing program, which intentionally created segregated public housing in areas that had been somewhat integrated. So it's interesting and ironic to see how some integrated areas were demolished so that segregated public housing could be established.
There's also the history of redlining across America in neighborhoods.
Yes, and I think that this fills out. Many people became very familiar with the redlining with the Ta-Nehisi Coates essay that appeared in The Atlantic, and this fills that out quite a bit. Everything from how the Federal Housing Administration prevented Black people from buying homes in certain areas to how the agency refused to insure loans from developers who would permit African Americans to live or buy in those communities. And it's not just about race. It has some commentary about class as well, but and everything from how zoning laws made waste disposal and industrial plants available in some neighborhoods, kept businesses out in other instances. He's right, too. And the critical thing about it is that it's not just in the South, which we tend to think about Jim Crow segregation and segregation in housing, especially. He gives examples everywhere from L.A., Detroit to New York and in the South.
Well, let's leave your list here to round out our list with a largely unknown history in the American Northwest, Daniel J. Sharfstein's Thunder in the Mountains.
Yes. That book I came across in part through the Howard connection in some ways, because it's about Chief Joseph Oliver Otis Howard and the Nez Perce War, where we see a conflict between General O.O. Howard, who had in some ways been against or an anti-imperialist, but who becomes an imperialist ultimately. And I thought this was a good post 4th of July Independence Day read, in the sense that it really does show how difficult, or the scope of U.S. power, like how, who makes certain decisions about the rights of Native peoples, the meaning of liberty and equality and its relation to ethnicity, color, place, class. And then I think it's also just a very good read for us to rethink American history, and to think about how complicated figures that we revere, like General O.O. Howard, who was commissioner of the Freedoms Bureau and who saw himself as anointed by God to abolish slavery, for instance, and how ultimately he leans a little bit towards imperialism as the U.S. encroaches upon the land of Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce.
A summer nonfiction list to round out our list yesterday of the best summer fiction. Dana Williams, chair of the Department of English at Howard University. A great list. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, that's all for us today. Tell us what you're reading. You can send a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm also on Twitter. I talk books. I talk politics. Hey, anything you want. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Anytime you like. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.